What's happening, everybody? You are now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight. The show will be geared towards upcoming and seasoned music producers to share and educate each other about what tools to use and what steps to take to become an industry standard music producer. And for those of you that would like to contact me for questions and suggestions, contact me, SPUDTOOTIGHT @gmail.com. And man, do I have a show for y'all today. The last couple of episodes, I've been speaking a lot upon my musical influences, what influenced me as a musician, as a keyboard player, producer, and I had the distinct pleasure of interviewing one of my musical influences, and that's Mr. George Duke. And I'm telling you guys, it was amazing speaking to him one-on-one for a half hour. I mean, it was a life-changing experience for me. And, you know, because George Duke is somebody who I just really admire as a keyboard player and as a producer and as an artist. And working with as many artists as he did in different genres is just amazing to me. I mean, just the different styles of music that he covers in his production, let alone his own music. I mean, it's seriously, for somebody, for me, coming up in the game as a keyboard player and a producer, he's definitely somebody I just really leaned on as overall musician, as a producer. Because, you know, when you listen to George Duke, I mean, he has so many different sides to him. I mean, there's something that I think every player can pick up something from him. I mean, it's not just jazz that he has, man. He has the funk background. He has the R&B background. I mean, George can go anywhere he wants to musically. I mean, he's that prolific of an artist and a player. You know, pretty much to generate anything that comes out of his mind, it's going to happen. And, you know, that's why I've leaned on him and listened to him so long coming up as a player. It's almost like I had to. You know, I knew that there was a certain level of playing that I wanted to achieve as a player. I wanted to be at a certain level as a keyboard player. And, you know, just listening to basic R&B, sometimes you're not going to be able to, you know, get too many chops to add to the arsenal. I mean, you have some really good foundation chords, and it really depends who you listen to also. You know, I don't want to classify any music to be one-sided, but predominantly, you know, what I wanted to do as a player, I really wanted to get into really heavy chord progressions, runs, really building my dexterity as a keyboard player so I can play different styles of music, from gospel to jazz to R&B, and also to be able to make my instruments come alive as a player. You know, I do have a background as a multi-instrumentalist. I do play guitar and bass, so having that ear, having that background allows me to make my instruments come alive as a keyboard player. At least I try to do it to the best of my ability, and listening to George Duke has definitely helped me achieve those goals, because he does, he becomes those instruments, whatever he's playing. I mean, I've heard him play bass solos on the keyboard, I've heard him play guitars on the keyboard, you know, and get into his chops and just on the Fender Rhodes and just a sense, you know, his leads are just amazing. I mean, again, it's something that every time I listen to his music, it always keeps me striving to become a better player. You know, I feel like I'm never done. I mean, you know, that journey is still going, and I'm still learning from him as we speak. You know, after the interview, you know, I went back and put up my old catalog of George Duke, man, and, you know, seriously, without being sounding biased, because I know I am in a lot of ways, but seriously, he's just that great of an artist and player to me. You really can't go wrong with a lot of the tracks that I listen to and I found on the CDs. And, you know, again, those are my tools for learning. When I feel like I'm getting stagnant as a player, I can always pull out the CDs of George Duke and pull something from it that I haven't heard before, maybe I didn't pay attention to, and try to add it to my arsenal. And, you know, again, I tell everybody who's around me, and they know, I say, man, you know, practicing takes time. You know, if you really want to learn that craft and you really want to be a great player, you got to put the time in. I mean, it's great because it's a learning process. And I you know, I think as a player, I'm always looking for new stuff to learn, you know, especially something that's going to, you know, that I have to really exercise daily. Some things, you know, some runs and some chords you're going to catch, you know, right on the whim and right away, but some of them, depending on the arrangement and the timing, is going to take a little bit more time. And also building your dexterity as a player is going to improve also, you know, because different traps requires different attacks and different timing. And, you know, repetition is going to create perfection along the way. So again, I'm definitely a disciple of his keyboard style of playing. I mean, it's totally amazing. And all the tracks that you hear during the interview will be George Duke. Those are all his covers that he's created. And, you know, I just thought it was just great, man, putting that compilation together for the interview. It definitely brought back a lot of memories of when I purchased the CDs and, you know, still on that high buzz of his new CDs coming out. So gonna play the interview, man. You guys sit back and enjoy it. And again, it's a great interview. I'm sure you guys will have a great time listening, and I'll follow up after the interview for some insights and thoughts on it.
What's happening, everybody? You're now tuning in to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight, and man, I have an extravagant show for you today. The last couple episodes I was giving you guys a little background on my influences, and I mentioned George Duke as being the messiah for keyboard playing for me. And today we have Mr. George Duke on the show. Everybody, ladies and gentlemen, welcome George Duke to the Producer's Corner with Spud Too Tight.
Hello, hello.
Man, George, what have you been up to? Man, just give me a little bit of, you know, background of what you've been doing the last couple of years up until now. I know I've been hitting your website pretty frequent. Pretty much every day, and I noticed that you're getting a new CD that's coming out.
Well, I'm gonna actually, I think the next thing that I do will be a live DVD. I cut some footage in Prague about 2 or 3 months ago, and then I did played about 3 hours at the Montreux Jazz Festival and brought in some extra musicians, you know, and just cut a lot of music, you know, live just to see what would happen. So I've got a live DVD that'll be coming out hopefully before the end of the year. The one that I did in Prague probably will only come out there, but I'm working on that right now.
Oh, nice.
So, and
nice.
I'm also producing an album for Everett Harp, who's a great saxophonist. He's doing a jazz record this time. I mean, a real jazz record. So we're looking forward to that. Among other things, I've been out touring.
Oh, man.
With Chaka Khan, actually, doing some other kind of dates with her.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man, Chaka, man, she's beautiful, man. I love her voice. You know, I'm only 34 years old, just to give you a heads up, but my background in music, man, I definitely can go back to the 70s, the 80s, and all the way up to current, man. So I definitely have a pretty good background of the 70s group, even when she was with Rufus.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so, I mean, I could definitely go back a couple of albums. And, you know, looking at your career, George, man, it's definitely inspiring for me, being that you're an artist, a musician, a producer, and a musical director. And, you know, how is it, you know, giving you the direction to keep those, you know, titles balanced, you know, with all the politics and, you know, just demands of the business? How are you able to maintain the schedule of all those the titles that you have?
Well, you know, I always thought that a career, at least for me, was much like investing in the money market. You know, I mean, you don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, I wanted to be able to write, to compose. I wanted to be able to produce. I wanted to be able to do movie scores. I mean, I thought, without spreading myself too thin, where I didn't think my talents existed, where they lied, I felt that I needed to distribute this out a little bit. You know, and so I decided to kind of be every man, every musician. And that's kind of what I did. You know, I figured that piano playing wasn't enough. There's a lot of great pianists out there, you know, and a lot of them are making a good living. Some of them are not.
Right.
You know, some that probably play the keys off of me. You know, but the point is if one thing goes down, then I have some eggs in another basket. And so the only thing that happened during my career is that the production kind of overshadowed me as an artist for about 15 or 20 years. And I just became a producer. I rarely went on the road. You know, went out a couple of times a year, played a few places. But mainly I was in the studio one act after another. And now that's changed.
Right.
I'm going back out and I'm doing more touring, which was the reason I got in the business in the first place, was to play live for people and try to touch them right away.
Right. You know, I mean, for me, I mean, that's the what really drove me into you, aside from being a keyboardist, like myself, man, it's just the production side of what you've been doing and the artists that you've produced. I'm like, man, you know, he's still doing his jazz funk fusion thing on his own. But, man, seriously, when I hear your production for other artists, George, I don't even know it's you half the time. It's so versatile. And the style, I was like, man, I had no idea that you produced that song, because I always looked at credits. When I was a young kid, I mean, I'm always opening up the CDs and records, look who's producing, and to see your name across some of the R&B tracks that I listen to, I was like, oh, man, you're just unstoppable, that versatility. And that's what I tried to implement and kind of grab your attributes as a producer and as a musician, kind of incorporate in my own style where I could be versatile and follow your direction and map of production.
Well, you know, for me, I actually decided that, you know, I make my own records. And I didn't want to make my records for the artists that I produce. So I wasn't going to take Jeffrey Osborne or Anita Baker and try to make them in my image.
Right.
I would try to take them and find out what's best about them or challenge them to be the best they can be and create their own statement. Because in the long run, I think the one thing that sets one artist apart from the next is individuality, musical individuality. You got to find out what that personality is and bring it out. That's the responsibility of a producer.
Right.
It changed in recent years where the producer became almost more important than the artist in many ways, because the producer did a track, the artist came and sang on it, and that's the end of it. And so all these artists began to sound the same because they sound like the producer.
I agree.
As opposed to the artist.
Right.
And so I didn't take that as a model. I said, no, if I work with, you know, Miles Davis, Miles Davis got to sound like Miles Davis. If I work with Barry Manilow, he got to sound like Barry Manilow. Jeffrey Osborne, whoever I was working with, Denise Williams, they all had to have, I tried to find out what makes them tick and what makes them special and bring that out, and found out it's my responsibility. And so that's why a lot of my productions don't sound the same.
Man, you're definitely doing a good job on it. My last couple episodes, I touched on the subject of building that artist-producer relationship between the artists. And, you know, just listening to the music and seeing how many songs and versus artists that are out there, I just kind of feel like it's a revolving door in a studio at times. You know, just that time and effort and that creativity is just not one sometimes with the artist. You know, you have a great track, it's good, but does it fit that artist?
Right.
You know, is it tailored for that Anita Baker? It's like, no, I'm pulling that from Jeffrey Osborne. It doesn't fit Anita. You know?
Yeah, well, it's just like I told Everett for the record that I'm working on with him right now. I said, man, I do not want to do one song with you that you don't absolutely love, that you think you can go out there and tear up live,
right,
that you can play, that represents you. I don't want this record to represent me.
Right.
This record has to represent the artist.
Right.
Because I got to make my own records, and I got enough to do.
Exactly.
So, but it's a different way of looking at things.
Right.
And but for me, I think it's the right way to do it.
That's right. No, I agree. You know, but one thing I do notice, you know, with the George Duke signature, I mean, I do notice that funk as your foundation on a lot of work that you do.
Yeah.
Even on some of the slower ballads, I still got that bop to it. You know what I mean? And that's definitely another thing that really stands out with me with you, you know, is that that funk background. Even like the tracks of Reach For It, Dookie Stick, I mean, those tracks, man, that's those high tracks that stick with me as a player. And because, you know, there's so much room, and it just takes your creativity to another level as far as funk. I mean, it's funk, but there's still room for adding your chops and progressions in there. You know what I mean? So it's just real inspired when I hear those tracks.
Yeah, I like to take the funk and just let it go where it will.
Right.
You know, because I have a lot of background in jazz, and so I take the straight up and down thing of the funk and you know, take the linear thing of jazz and put them together.
That's right.
You know, and make it work. For me, man, you know, that funk is all about, really, about the blues feeling. You know, it's an Afrocentric thing. It's an interesting thing I actually call... I have a word for it called the Ancient Source. You know, I actually wrote a song about it on one of my albums called The Ancient Source.
Uh-huh.
And that, to me, is the thing that makes this stuff work, because it's actually a spiritual thing.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's like, and you, it's something you can't quite put your finger around it, but you know it when you hear it because it's got that thang on it.
Right, that feel.
That feel, it's that thang.
Yeah.
T-H-A-N-G.
That's right.
I say, like, taking it from Duke Ellis, if it ain't got that thang.
That's right.
It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that,
thang. That's right. All day long.
That's what I'm saying. That doesn't, whatever it is.
Right.
So it's got to have that ancient source, you know, and that's available for everybody to tap into it if they want to.
Well, I definitely did it, man, and you're definitely the gateway I used when I produced and composed my music. You know, it's one thing when I found myself when I'm producing an artist for R&B, and you know, it's definitely a hot track. The creativity is there, but it's nothing like when I create my own instrumentals. I don't feel like I have that box. You know what I mean? I'm just
right.
Grooving, and the music just kind of takes me there on its own. And sometimes it's not really structured enough for an artist to sing around it, but it's just a great track again, just because I have no boundaries again when I'm doing my jazz, my smooth jazz stuff anyways.
Yeah, that's, people ask me that sometimes. But, I actually don't feel that constricted when I'm writing for other people, because I really try to keep them in mind. It's almost like when I'm doing a track that has, you know, bass and drums, and I'm trying to get like a real drum sound or a real bass sound or even a guitar, which is even more difficult to do, and you know, in certain
right.
brass instruments, I actually put myself in that head and say, okay, now I'm a trumpet player. I'm not a piano player playing a trumpet part. I'm a trumpet player.
That's right.
And I try to breathe like a trumpet player and the whole bit to make the part more realistic, so I actually become another person. And I think in some respects, that's the key to putting those tracks together, if you're doing electronic tracks.
Right.
You know, is to actually become another musician. You know, because if you're the same guy playing drums, playing bass, the same musician playing all those instruments, I'm not saying it can't work.
Sure.
But I think it takes on another avenue if you can take on another personality. It's like acting.
Right, exactly.
You know, and you actually, if you start thinking like a bass player, your parts are going to sound more like a regular bass player.
Right.
If that's what you're going for.
Exactly. No, I agree. And, you know, I think having that keyboard background, just at the keyboard, it allows the composer to think like another instrument. You know, if you're a piano player, sometimes I think piano players play like a piano player. You know, they don't hear the bass parts or the strings or the brass or, you know, just a lot of lead synths, you know, because their playing style and their dexterity is like a piano player. But I think when you get into the keyboard aspect of it, the sounds just kind of make you create a little bit better than, you know.
Yeah, Stanley Clark used to talk to me about that all the time. He used to hear guys play bass parts. He said, well, they're not playing like a bass player. They're playing this like a keyboard player.
Right.
Or something else. So,
right.
You know, we've had that conversation before.
How was it working with Stanley, man? I know you guys had a huge relationship and a long relationship coming up in the game, composing and producing together and touring.
Yeah, well, Stanley's like my younger brother, you know. He's an incredible musician, man. Absolutely incredible musician that is as deep musically as I am.
Yeah.
And I can go, you know, play everything from classical music to funk and love it all. And so he's been much like me. That's who he is.
Right.
We're the same kind of people, though his background's a little different than mine. He's a little more on the rock side. I'm a little more on the funk church side.
Right.
And so you put the two of us together, and it tends to work out pretty well. You know, so we've done, yeah, I mean, I saw him in Europe, and we were hanging out, and we sent emails back and forth to each other all the time. So that's like my buddy.
Man, so I got a couple of Stanley Clark's albums, even from his younger years, man, and the stuff that he did for the Boys in Hood soundtrack was phenomenal.
Oh, yeah. Bad boy.
Oh, yeah. Chop, man. He's the guy on the bass, you know what I mean? Now, I know you and Algero did some stuff together, man, and one on the Hearts Horizon CD.
Yes.
Man, the track, believe it or not, the favorite track on that album for me is More Love.
Oh, really?
Oh, George, that track there, man, the chord progression that you're using, the flow of the track, I love that song, man. That is the track.
That's a very well-written song by a guy named Spud Murphy, I think was his name.
Really?
I think that was his name. Yeah, it was a guy who used to write for, if I'm correct, if that's right, his name. I haven't seen him in a long time.
Right.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not Spud Murphy. It's Jack Siegel.
Okay.
Is his name. And I think he used to write songs for Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and all of that. And he sent this song in, and I started listening to it, and I said, Al, you need to listen to this song, because lyrically, it's kind of where we are in our life.
Right.
And I think it's something you could really sing and mean these lyrics. The only regret I had, man, is that I loved a lot of what I did on there. You know, the song sounds good, but I wish, in hindsight, that I had done some other things. You know, I could have made it better. You know, it's one of those kind of things where you, it's almost like you're never satisfied.
Right.
Yeah, that one, there was a lot of possibilities in that. I could have made that better.
Really?
Yeah, man.
Well, you had me fooled, man, because I'll tell you, that's my favorite track on the album. I mean, it was a good album, but that track alone is, it's inspiring to hear it. You know, again, the possibilities. And then your creativity and your chord arrangements, yours, just phenomenal.
Yeah, well, thank you. It was, you know, that's my Quincy Jones stuff in there.
Right, man, speaking of Quincy Jones.
I was just hanging out with Quincy.
Really?
Yeah, we were in Montreal together down in Harry's Bar hanging out. You know, after he came to my show, and so, you know, actually I did a show there with Shaka, and so he came to that and he introduced us, and then about 3-4 days later, we went out and did some other dates, and I came back and did my own show. He was still there, and he came up and introduced me on my show, and then after we were finished, we went to Harry's Bar, hanging out, talking, and talking about old times, and, you know, of course, the thing with Michael was very recent, you know, so that was obviously a topic of conversation, but...
Yeah, I bet.
But he's doing well, and, you know, still a great cat, man.
Oh, man. Like I said, I was going to bring up the Quincy Jones Back on the Block CD.
Oh, yeah.
Man, this is where Spud Too Tight kind of gave birth to my leads and my runs. It's the track you did on One Man Woman.
Oh.
Remember that one? Oh, my God, man. You went into that G minor run, George, on the break? Oh. And here's the thing. You were pitch bending a piano sound. You know what I mean? It's kind of like that's unheard of for most people.
Oh, I'd love to do that, man. I do that nowadays. I don't remember that, but the only one I remember is that the thing I did with Take Six on there. But that, yeah, I have to go back and check that out now.
Oh, man, I know the track. That's on track 11.
Okay.
You're going to CD.
Oh, you got it, huh?
Oh, man, I got all your stuff, man. But, you know, like I said, the pitch bend is like, you know, for most people, it's like, man, why would you pitch bend a piano sound? And, you know, getting into the George Duke world, it's like, man, why not? You know what I mean?
You know, man, let me tell you the truth. The reason I actually fell in love with playing the synthesizer is because I could bend a note. The one thing about playing piano is I said, man, you can't really bend a note in the real world. I mean, it's
right.
Like you do slide your fingers around everything to try to make believe you've been in a note.
Right.
But to say what I wanted to say in my heart, I really needed to be able to do that. You know, make that cry. That,
right, that little half-step jump, even to be doing that half-step.
Yes, sir. And so I took it, and I said, finally, when a piano was available to play electronically, I said, oh, it's on now.
Man, I know, man. I noticed that when you first started playing the synthesizers, the first ones you were on was, I think, the ARP 2600 and the Mini Moog.
Yeah, I wasn't really good on the ARP 2600. I played Mini Moog, actually, an ARP Odyssey, a little small one.
Right.
2600 was a little advanced for me.
Didn't Frank Zappa introduce you to the ARP?
Sure did.
Really?
Sure did. Yeah, he actually bought a Mini Moog and just put it on my keyboards and just said, maybe you'll bump it and the sound will come out. But he put a 2600 there at first, and I looked at all these wires and these knobs and these...
Right.
I felt like I was a scientist or something.
Right, like a switchboard operator, man. That thing was like a big refrigerator wall you just plug and play, but it had the nice filters that you can play in real time with, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of like when the Mini Moog came out.
I started reading the manual, and I was like, oh, this is forget it. So then he got me a Mini Moog, and I said, okay, well, this looks like it's a little cool. But once I found out by accident that you could bend a note, it was over.
Man, I'm already knowing. I swear, man, the technique for pitch bending, I've implemented that, and I got that from you. Because, like I said, just adds a whole feel. I do it a lot on, like, a lot of lead synths. I do a lot of lead synths, solo signs. And like you said, having that little pitch bend, you know, kind of has almost like a vibro on a vocal a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just creates a whole feel to the whole note. You know what I mean? Just gives it a little gloss and a little spice.
Put some life in the note.
Yeah, totally. Now, what synths are you running these days? What are you playing on now?
Well, it's what I do live is a little different than what I, using the studio. So,
right.
As a matter of fact, I'm kind of in between right now. I've still been using the Motiv S8s or XS8s, depending on what I'm doing, from Yamaha. I've been using those as my main controllers. And then I have a lot of virtual instruments and stuff in a computer on my laptop. And I have, of course, I have an acoustic piano and this strap-on instrument, the AX7, that I wear around my neck when I get ready to get funky.
Right.
So, you know, those are my basic instruments live. But in the studio, I'm in here with the Giga Studio and Logic, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Whatever I can have, you know, with a host of virtual instruments and a lot of analog instruments at the same time.
Right.
Including a real Rode, several different Rodes, Wurlitzers and clavinets and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. The original?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow. So you're just micing that in then with the Fender Rhodes and the Wurlitzer then, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, nice, nice. Speaking of which, man, I know that you're a Logic Pro user, and
yes.
So am I.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's like I came into the Logic world 4 years ago, crossing over from Pro Tools and Cubase 5.0 and Cubase SX. And, you know, no discredit to Cubase or Pro Tools, you know, because I like them all, and I really think it's depending on the user, but, you know, being a player, I didn't have the control, you know, of my production and my sounds and just my overall mix until I crossed over to Logic, you know, just for the samples of, like, you know, your kicks, snares, your claps. As far as my drum program, man, it was just really hard trying to get all those sounds in to the computer because I'm not an MTC user. I do everything and I channel all my sounds through my keyboards.
Right.
You know, so crossing over to that Logic Pro, I felt that, you know, I was going to be compatible with the industry because with Logic I can open up Pro Tools and run the hardware on Logic, you know, and be able to have that file sharing between the two parties was really helpful.
Yeah, you know, I've been with Logic a long time. I mean, before they were Logic, when
you were E-Magic, yeah.
You know, so I go way back with the guys from Germany, you know, when it was introduced to me, and it's been a great program for a long time. It just continues to grow, and I'm, as a matter of fact, already ordered my Logic 9.
Oh, did you?
Yes, sir. Just to get that going, and I can't wait for everything to go, you know, 64-bit. I think that's going to make a big difference.
Oh, man, can you imagine that? What kind of sound cards do you think is going to be the whole 64-bit, though?
Say it again?
What kind of sound cards or interfaces is going to be able to, you know, record 64-bit?
Well, you know, Kontakt is 64-bit now. Anyway, I'm using it on a laptop.
Really?
I use it on a laptop with this past weekend I did a gig in Norfolk, Virginia, and it works great, man. I don't get any hang-ups, nothing. I mean, it's really efficient.
Is it FireWire or USB?
We're using FireWire, I believe.
400, was it 800 port on that?
Oh, man, I don't remember. I'm not sure. You'd have to ask my tech.
Sure.
I'm just a piano player. You know what, man? Tell you the truth, I used to really be into all of that. I mean, programming. I used to program all my own sounds,
because
you know, you couldn't save anything anyway.
Right.
So I did, you know, programming became very important. You know, now I find something I kind of like, and then I tweak it a little bit and save it.
Sure,
that's
sure.
As far as I go, you know, I have somebody else to set all that stuff up, and he's much more brilliant than me in terms of that, so
right.
I let him get into that.
Yeah, no, I understand. Now, like, for your pre's, what pre's are you using with your synths? I mean, what do you run them? So are you just running them line in or to your interfaces, or do you run those through a pre, or?
Well, it's all, everything is backline. You know, I have a little Mackie console. It's about a little 8-channel. It depends on what they have available.
Sure.
I use a little Mackie console,
okay,
which we separate going to the house system as opposed to what comes to me on stage, because I don't want to have to control what they hear out front.
Sure.
You know, so we have a split there between I have a top keyboard and a bottom keyboard, and then, of course, the actual acoustic piano, my microphones, and the thing I wear around my neck, and that all goes separately out to the house.
Okay.
And then I have my own mix on stage and do what I want to do. That's really about it. We use a Hammerfall interface.
Hammerfall. Who's that by? Is that SSL or?
No, I don't know. It's Hammerfall. It's all,
oh, that's their brand, okay.
Something that my tech Andrew turned me on to.
He's
really a brilliant cat, man, the way he set my system up now. Because I used to have some issues, you know, people could see me on stage throwing stuff around because I'd be pissed off.
Right.
You know, but now it's really become very stable, and I found a host of samples and virtual instruments I can use that are just incredible.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of them out there.
The only difference now compared to what we used to be able to do, and it's coming back around a little bit to that now, is that I love to be able back in the day to start a solo sound, for example, start it with one sound and change it somewhere along the line and let it kind of merge into something else.
Sure, like morphing, audio morphing.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, oh yeah, totally.
And you can still do that. I don't hear a lot of people today doing that, but that was a thing I used to love to do in the past that I have not been able to do with virtual instruments because you don't have that kind of control.
Right. It's like if you're in that record mode, you know, it's not going to allow you to change the alterations of it. You know, I think we'll probably have to go back to the hardware, the external boards to do that, I'm thinking.
Well, they got instruments now that'll do it. I mean, you know, and record everything that you do. Uh-huh. Or even live, you can adjust the sound. You know, if you get that kind of synthesizer that allows that kind of control,
sure.
You want to do that. So it's sort of coming back around a little bit.
Right. Man, for your touring, I mean, I know you're doing so many concerts. You know, looking at your website, you're doing a lot of benefit concerts. You know, the upcoming CD tours. Generally, on an average, how long does it take you to prepare for a tour?
It depends on what I'm doing. You know, the dates I did with Shaka, we basically did one rehearsal. I brought the band into my studio. We rehearsed for a couple of hours and then went and did it. Now, we're doing, I've done some dates with Shaka where we did her full, you know, R&B pop show. That's a different thing.
Right.
The show that I've been doing recently is with my trio, which is just, you know, upright bass and electric both. And me just playing piano or Fender Rhodes.
Right.
And that's the show, and a drummer. And she's singing a lot of her jazz material, which is a little different than what she normally does, so she's digging it because it gives her another way of looking at music and something, you know, different to do. And so that's been working out pretty well, and it's sort of started to circulate among promoters now. I said, oh, really? That's happening. So we're starting to get other offers now.
Oh, nice.
But normally, I use a group of musicians who I've worked with for a long time, and I don't need to rehearse that much.
Right.
I came in and rehearsed for a couple of days before I went to this last European tour because I wanted to do a Frank Zappa tribute.
Right.
I wanted to add a couple of tunes and stuff for this DVD that I'm doing that we hadn't been doing. And it took me a couple of days. We came in and rehearsed, especially the Zappa material.
Right.
Which is, you know, you're not just going to walk in and play that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Zappa, man, he's on another level with his production.
Yeah, not the more involved stuff. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
There's so many different time signature changes. You got to understand what you're doing.
Right.
So it took us a couple of days to really knock that out, you know.
Right. You know, I think, you know, your ability as a player, you know, for me, I think it changes over time, you know, doing it from like the 70s and even for me growing up, pretty much predominantly playing in the 80s, I think my style would, and as a keyboard player's changes is my ear got better and more mature, you know what I mean? So like you listen to so many different genres, I think that's what's keeping me and other players moving is just the amount of music that we have around us, surrounds us. You know, because I try not to limit myself to just, you know, R&B or hip-hop. You know, I try to keep my mind open to, like, rock, you know, pop, jazz, definitely, blues, funk.
Man, it can only help you. You know, it's funny, man. Back in the day, I used to have musicians say, man, why you want to learn how to read music? Why you want to learn all this other stuff? And I said, because I want to be a comprehensive musician. You know, there may be certain things I'm stronger at.
Right.
I want to know what's going on there, so I might want to include it in my musical palette, in my arsenal.
Definitely.
You know, and so if I need to incorporate some of that, I can.
Right.
Cannibal Adderley, who's an incredible saxophonist who's no longer with us, told me that he used to bring me over to his house and say, man, come here, man. He says, I want you to hear something. And he played me some Brazilian stuff by Milton Nascimento and some other things. He said, man, you need to listen to this because you need to include this in your arsenal.
Wow.
You know, those are the kind of musicians I work with. You know, Miles Davis used to tell me stuff. He said, hey, dude, I want you to write me a tune based around this chord. You see that chord right there?
Yeah.
Do that. And so I said, oh, okay. And
right.
Out there, you know, that'd be one thing. You know, Frank Zappa used to tell me, man, he said, George, you need to learn to play synthesizer.
Right.
You need to sing. You need to learn how to come out from behind those keyboards and let your personality out. I mean, you know, and those are all constructive for a young kid things that I took to heart, you know.
Right.
And try to become inclusive and not be so narrow, because, man, Frank Zappa told me, he said, man, you are much too straight, jagged player. He said, you know,
right.
You need to open up.
Right, right.
And so that's why I'm as much of a gumbo as I am right now. Because of people like that.
Right. You know, I read a posting on your forum that you posted. It's probably one of the things I saw. It's kind of old, but it was real interesting. An observation.
Yeah.
Man, give me a little background. I know it was dealing with the, you know, your jazz background and, you know, some of the critics out there.
Right.
You know, trying to, again, put us in a box of what they feel jazz should be.
Right.
You know, I just think it's way off, you know.
I tell you, Spud, this, I had no idea that this was going to elicit as much response as it did. And as a matter of fact, I planned to take it down a year ago. The problem is I keep getting emails, and it's continuing to this day. I have a whole host of other emails that I could put up, and I'll probably do it. This will be the last year for it, I promise everybody. You know, but it just, it's an interesting subject. And I started basically with the concept of saying that I've been working at a lot of schools and doing various things at schools and working with kids, and I noticed that there was a concerted effort among these students not to play Afrocentrically. Now, let me explain that a little bit. It's like these guys were playing solo, like classical players.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, I mean, it didn't matter what color they were. Black players,
Right.
It seemed like they weren't aware of the blues, or they weren't aware of what I call the ancient source.
That's right.
You know? And I just wanted to know if anybody else realized that. Because I said, if you take that kind of, the Afrocentricness of jazz out of it, that takes out what I love about jazz.
Yes, yeah.
I said, what makes jazz work to me, all of that, is the fact that you got the Afrocentric thing and the European element put together. And that's what makes it very interesting and makes it work. If you take one from the other, I'm not sure it works as well, at least for me. So
right.
I wondered if anybody else noticed it. Man, the amount of emails I got was phenomenal. Everything from people accusing me of being the problem with music today to, you know, people agreeing with me and people going much further than I went, you know, talking about the subject matter. Very, very interesting. I still encourage people to write in and weigh in on the subject.
Right. No, I totally agree.
Whether musicians are abandoning that and why.
Right.
And there were a lot of interesting thoughts on why.
I believe it. We'll leave that alone.
That's a deep subject, man.
It is. You know, with the responses they were getting, I was like, man, this is totally amazing. And it was real cool for you to come out and, you know, post that, because a lot of times, you know, artists, you know, not knowing the personal business, but, you know, they kind of shy away from the fans and really not to let us go on, you know, what's going on within your music world. And that was real cool that you shared that with everybody. That was real inspired for me again.
Yeah. Oh, I've had people, you want to leave it alone. I'll leave it alone.
We'll do that in another show, man.
Cool, you got it.
Well, George, man, I do appreciate the time that you've taken with this interview, man. Seriously, this is really a dream come true for me. I really can't thank you enough. And, again, you inspire me so much as a keyboardist, man. I just really want to take my hat off to you and to thank you. How you inspired me as, you know, being my Obi-Wan Kenobi as a keyboard player. So,
well, I look forward to hearing your stuff, man. I've been, Monica was telling me about it.
Oh, lovely, man. I'm working on some stuff now that I'm just kind of putting my own instrumentals together, man. It's definitely a heavy George Duke influence track, and I definitely want to get that to you so you can check it out. So, man, please don't be a stranger. I would love to have you back on the show and chop it up with me again, man. We'll keep it going.
All right, Spud. Appreciate everything you're doing, man.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, George.
All right.
Take it easy.
Later.
What a great interview. Man, George is the man. What a cool dude, man. You know, it was just real cool, man, chopping it up with him, man, for a half hour. Really seeing the, for me, it was like seeing the other side of it, man. You know, he's done everything and produced everybody, and just to have that input and to see his thoughts on the business and, you know, the direction of composing and really taking music and just making yourself a better all musician was really a life experience for me. And, you know, I can't thank him enough for coming on the show and chopping it up with me. Please hit his website up. He has a great website that I think it would be really informational for everybody who knows about George Duke and for the listening audience who are new to the George Duke experience. And his website is www.georgeduke.com. And that's www.georgeduke.com. And before we leave the show today, man, I want to share something with the listening audience. Having that R&B background that I have, I'm also heavy into smooth jazz. And I wanted to share a track that I've composed with my jazz background and my R&B background, my rock background, and kind of put everything together so I could express myself as a musician the best way I could. And I'm playing it for the first time over the airwaves, and just so everybody can get a taste, a feel of my style and what I like to do. Aside from producing other artists, I also like to do instrumentals, and having that George Duke influence in me allows me to compose and, you know, create music for myself. You know, because it's one thing when you work with an artist, they have their views, and you guys got to really compromise on your musical ideas. But when you're working on your own, I get a chance to really cultivate all my ideas on my own project, and it's just really nice having that freedom of expression. So I'm just going to let the track play out for the remainder of the show, and tune in next week, and I'll be discussing some new music topics. You guys take it easy. Be good.